Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello there. Welcome to another edition of the Morning Show podcast. I'm Kylie Gillies' best friend, Larry.
And I'm Larry's best friend, Kylie Gillies.
Oh, that sounds right, doesn't it? Now, ahead for you on this episode, the man behind one of the catchiest songs of all time. We're going to chat to Robin Thicke about Blurred Lines, as well as his brand new music.
Our controversial royal biographer, Lady Colin Campbell, shares her thoughts on Meghan and Harry's bombshell interview with Oprah.
Always an interesting chat, huh? Author and former celebrity manager, Melanie Blake, spills about the secret scandals, betrayals, and the outrageous behaviour behind the scenes of TV soaps.
The stories she can tell, plus Candace Warner, Tim Campbell and 90s pin-up Nathan Harvey. Remember Nathan?
Oh, yeah. But first, it was a senseless attack that left a young woman with horrific injuries.
8 years after she was deliberately set alight in her own home, Dana Vuolin shares her inspiring story of triumph.
Well, it was the attack felt right around the country. Dana Vuolin, at just 25 years of age, was set alight and left to die.
Emerging from adversity with a lot of strength, the Perth native has reset her path and is well and truly kicking goals.
It was an early February morning in 2012 when Dana Vuolin woke to find a woman in her apartment dousing her in methylated spirits. What happened next shocked the nation.
I was engulfed in flames. I cupped my hands on my face and started screaming.
With third-degree burns to more than 60% of her body, Dana nearly died.
I was shattered, like my soul was broken. I could feel it pouring out of everything.
But this is more than a story of survival against the odds. 9 years after that harrowing encounter, Dana is proving the old adage that what doesn't kill you, in fact, makes you stronger.
In my wildest dreams in the beginning, I didn't for one second think I could look in the mirror and see the old Dana again.
The motivational keynote speaker also found success as an author and has graduated university with multiple degrees, the most recent, a master's in science.
And Dana Vuolin joins us live from Perth this morning. Always great to see you, Dana.
Hi, guys. How are you?
We are great. How are you going, more to the point?
Good. Really good, actually. Like, surprisingly well. I've obviously, just finished my third degree at uni, my master's in science, specifically nursing, because I want to get into cosmetics and disfigurement to be able to give back more than I do now. And I'm actually looking forward to having a life again more than anything.
Wow.
Dana, that's amazing. So you're now motivated to try and pour yourself into helping others who've gone through what you have gone through. Obviously, certainly no one can live through what you have, but to try and help in that nursing sense, to try and help people who've been through burns?
Yeah, not just burns. People were born with birth defects, disfigurements, had disfigurement from car accident, cancer survivors. Disfigurement doesn't just come in one form and just doesn't come from burns. But yes, that's my goal.
So 9 years, we say it's been 9 years.
Yeah.
Sounds like you are very, very busy. How often do you go back to that place, though, Dana, in your mind? Are you too busy to even think of it these days, or do you find yourself drawn back there from time to time?
So I don't ever try to relive the day or the person that did it to me, because I want to give them that power. But because I just did so many rotations for the last few years in different hospitals, it reminded me of, like, walking into a patient's room, their heartache and their family's heartache, because when somebody's injured to such a calibre, everybody's affected. But also, when I'm having a really big surgery, like I had my back replaced a couple of years back, and I was laying essentially on my stomach for 2 months, that's the only time I really think of the time of when it happened. Otherwise, I'm kind of a person that looks forward. I think if you look back, you're only going to go backwards and get a sore neck.
Onward.
There's absolutely no doubt that there's something extraordinarily special about your mindset, Dana. You have to be of a certain composition to be able to survive this. An element of crazy, perhaps, but mostly it's the resolve. Your ability, I'm just listening to you in the setup package, you were saying your soul was broken, you felt it pouring out of you. But to look at you now, you are absolutely put back together in so many ways. Where do you find that strength? And where do you find that motivation?
It's going to sound very cliche, but the strength I found in love. So I'm a person that sticks to decisions. And I decided I was never going to die or kill myself. I couldn't even if I wanted to, I was so disabled. But when you have an injury this big, it didn't just affect me, it affected my family so deeply and my friends and the medical community and the judicial system. And on those days when it was really hard to fight for, like, and move forward, I fought for them. How dare I give up on people who didn't give up on me? But also, you know, I'm not a hateful person. I don't believe in revenge. It's like drinking poison, but I think success is a wicked revenge, so that drove me as well. But, look, I'm going to wake up every day anyway if I've decided to live. Why would I wake up and have a crappy life versus waking up and giving it my all and having the best life I can? So it seems black and white to me.
Yeah, Dana, you just say graduated your third degree. That was a master's in science. Yep. Is this the path you think your life would have taken if not for the events of 9 years ago? Do you think you were ever on that path, or do you think you would have been doing something different?
It's hard to say that anyone could have been on this path. Like, it's not just that I just did my third degree. I'm an international author and speaker, and I was always an academic, so I'd done two of my degrees before my burn. Part of my identity, I guess, now is something that I pride myself on is I'm actually known for making one of the biggest recoveries in the world. Yeah. So I don't think, regardless of how driven or ambitious I was, I would have been known for my recoveries. I just would have, you know, I always say the world has plenty of beautiful blondes. What it needs now is more beautiful minds and beautiful hearts. And at least, like, that way I am different. And now I'm as unique on the outside as I am on the inside. And I get to be hope. You know, I get to be like mothers whose children I burnt, who ring me or message me and tell me, like, I showed my daughter or my son your photos and you've given them hope. And that's something that doesn't matter.
What a gift.
How hard you drive, like, or what you do, you cannot give to someone unless you've experienced. So I know it wouldn't have been the same path.
Dana, you touched really briefly just then on revenge, and you talk about your recovery, which has been just extraordinary. Well, how much of that has been able to let go of the anger for what happened? Have you ever had any contact with your attacker?
No, only just during court. And I guess I'm just not a hateful person. Again, I decided to live, so why would I live and be angry? I do, especially in the beginning, I would get angry when I, like, would hear my mum or my sister or my family or friends cry, but also try to cover it up for me because I was so broken. And, like, do what you want to me. I'm pretty resilient, as we now know. But don't mess with my family. Like, that makes me mad. And I never an apology or recognition or growth on, but I guess you can't expect that because someone who does something like this isn't, in my opinion, sane of mind.
Dana, we must wrap it up here and we'll say goodbye, but yesterday the marches with thousands and thousands and thousands of women marching against violence throughout the country, your thoughts?
So proud. Unfortunately, delayed. We should have all been marching years ago, but that's just not how the world works. Regardless, like, it made my heart want to explode. Domestic violence isn't just for women. Men get domestic violence as well, and I love that. I saw men in there. I saw men supporting women, women supporting men, and I've had a lot of friends go through domestic violence situations, and they're not as black and white as if you haven't been through one. So, like, when you say, oh, get out to your girlfriend, it's not that easy. So I'm just really proud. And the only way we can empower ourselves is by creating awareness.
Yeah. Well said. Cool. Dana, an absolute treat talking to you. It's easy to see why you're inspiring so many across the country. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, guys.
Well, he may be a household name now, but there's no denying Robin Thicke has done the hard yards to get exactly where he is today.
You may just think you know him for Blurred Lines, but 10 years before that, he was riding the streets of New York City. And Robin Thicke joins us from his home in LA. Hi, Robin. Congrats on the new music. You've had so much success, more than some musicians could ever hope for. What was it like finally to get this album out? 7 years.
Well, you know, I've just been through a lot over these last 7 years. My father passed away. My mentor passed. I've had three new beautiful children, Mia, Lola, and Luca. And so there was just a lot that I wanted to write about. And when I lost my mentor last year, I really rededicated myself to my music, and I wanted to put this album out to honor him and my father.
And Robin, I think that really comes across too, that almost that there's been a shift in focus for you in your music, if you like, with, you know, big priority on family. Do you think that was partly informed a little bit by, you know, some of the backlash initially to Blurred Lines has changed your approach to music in some ways?
Well, I think, you know, the backlash of Blurred Lines just made me think about what my message is, you know, and not letting trying to be famous or trying to get noticed or doing, you know, in that era, I was like, I'll do whatever it takes to get there, you know. I just want people to know who I am and know my music, because I've been doing it for 20 years, you know, and I was looking for that international fame. And then when I got it, it didn't really soothe my soul or make me a better person, you know. So I've had this time to reflect and learn about myself and focus on family. And, you know, now I know I'm back to what I want my musical message to really be, you know.
Yeah, which is really, really interesting. It's called On Earth and in Heaven. So we get that. And you talked about your father, of course, the late fabulous Alan Thicke.
Yes.
Your memories of him, how do you remember him?
Oh, I mean, he was my hero. He was my best buddy. It was my first phone call with good news and my first phone call for bad news. You know, he was so charming and funny. And, you know, I always wanted to separate myself from him and do things my own way. But now that he's moved on and I've taken on the role of patriarch in my family, and, you know, and I find myself sounding like him and saying all the same things he said, and that's how he's remembered in my heart and in our family, is I'm just turning into him more and more every day.
What a wonderful legacy, Robin. I read that you try and emulate him as a father with your kids, which is just so touching. And I also understand, happy birthday for this week. Your fiance got you a framed photo of your father holding up your album and saying, I'm proud of you, love, Dad.
You're going to get me all gift. Choked up, but that was a pretty amazing gift. She knows what my father meant to me, and especially with this album being dedicated to him in that way. And you know, so that was a very, very meaningful gift to me in every way. She's the best.
It's funny, as we get older, we have time to reflect, don't we, Robin? So you did everything. You didn't want to be like your dad, and yet now you're the dad.
Well, I wanted to be like him in his charm and savoir-faire, you know, and his spirit, but I wanted to make my own mark and be my own man. And now that I have children and I realize what a great example and what a great human being he was. And how, I mean, I did get to tell him before he passed. We got to have some great talks, some great grown man talks, and he knows how much I loved and appreciated him.
But as a dad, you just want to make things easy for your kids, don't you? That's sort of what we tend to do. Funny.
So, Robin, tell us about this new album. There's a lot of noise around it, quite rightly. You've poured your heart and soul into this. And how is it different to what people might expect, I guess, from you?
Well, you know, the people that really have followed my music outside of Blurred Lines know that I'm a soul man, know that I'm a singer-songwriter at heart. I'm not really a pop star in any way. You know, I had a little taste of that. But really, I'm a musician and a songwriter, producer. And so this album is very different from what everyone else is doing in some ways out there. You know, it's from my heart, and it's about my life, and it's about overcoming whatever life throws at you and really turning it into something positive and something beautiful and meaning and a life worth living, you know.
We started off this chat talking about real estate, just as we say goodbye, because we are out of time. But you lost your house in the Malibu fires a few years back. How you're yes. going okay now with all of that?
Well, you know, when you put that in the middle of losing my father and my mentor and COVID and these other things that we've all had to deal with, you know, that's just stuff. And I was lucky enough that I can rebuild. But, you know, during these times, we really know what's really important. And that's our family and our friendships and taking care of one another. And for me now, it's all about planning for the future. I used to focus on the present have a good time. But now now I'm focused on the future for myself and my family.
Robin, you sound like you're in a sensational place. We're very grateful for you joining us here on The Morning Show. Good luck with the new album and happy birthday for this week.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Robin. Robin's new album, it's called On Earth and in Heaven. It's available to stream or download.
Well, Lady Colin Campbell is no stranger to a headline. Her 1992 book, Diana in Private, became one of the most controversial royal titles of all time, but was lapped up by readers everywhere, landing her on the New York Times bestseller list.
Lady Colin Campbell followed it up with her 2020 release, Meghan and Harry, The Real Story. Just last week, she shared her thoughts on social media about that Oprah interview.
And Lady Colin Campbell joins us live now from Castle Goring. Welcome to the show. Great to see you. What was your first reaction to the Oprah interview?
Well, I thought that Meghan and Oprah were very professional. They are two pros. They're very like-minded in many ways. And I thought that they actually, Meghan came across rather well for the first half of her solo appearance. And then I think she overplayed her hand and we began to get glimpses of the real Meghan. And I thought by the end of it, the whole thing was sick-making. I think it's an exercise in treachery.
An exercise in treachery. They're strong words. In the interview, Meghan said she hadn't done any research about Harry before marrying into the family. Did that surprise you?
Well, my dear, if you believe that, you'll believe that I'm the tooth fairy and I'm going to bring you a 50-carat diamond at the end of this phone call. And moreover, not only is it completely incredible, but the fact of the matter is that Omid Scobie, in his book, which, of course, we all know that she leaked information about, she confirms in his book that both she and Harry Googled each other. So, you know, the problem with Meghan is that if it's Tuesday, the sun rises in the west and sets in the east, and if it's Thursday, it rises in the east and sets in the west. I mean, she's wildly inconsistent. And, you know, she plays with facts the way a sculptress plays with clay.
We know you didn't speak to either Harry or Meghan directly for your book about them. You spoke to many people around them, however, but many of those people remained anonymous. How do you know the information that you have is correct?
Well, because if you've read the book, which I suspect you most likely haven't, and I can't blame you for not reading it, the fact of the matter is everything I said last year, and remember, it took me a year to write the book, so it started 2 years ago, everything I said has foreshadowed what is happening now. And everything I said the palace was afraid of is actually happening or has happened. So, you know, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. Everything I've said, and I'm not a fortune teller, has turned out to be accurate.
Moving forward, what do you think the ramifications are going to be for the royal family there in the UK in the wake of this Oprah interview? What's going to happen, Lady Colin Campbell?
Well, I know that people, by and large, in this country are absolutely incensed. I think it's the odds are 3/4 to 1/4 in favour, and it's mostly the young who are in favour because they're gullible and they don't really understand what's going on. I hope that the massive amount of support that is being shown to the Queen, Prince Charles, Prince William, will actually just, you know, it will get us from one shore to another. Let us put it that way.
Well, one of the subjects of debate surrounds Harry and Meghan's claims of racism, both within the royal family and the broader British tabloids and public. Now, we rarely see the royal family responding to specific criticisms. However, both the Queen and Prince William have made statements. Where does this all go to from here, do you think?
Well, I mean, I actually have spoken to one of the most eminent psychiatrists, stroke psychoanalysts in the world, who has been advising me. And they are of the opinion that Meghan is exhibiting signs of narcissistic personality disorder and antisocial personality disorder, with, and both she and Harry also exhibit signs of paranoia. So where is it going? I think the royal family at some point is going to have to make it apparent that we are dealing with two very disturbed and or sick individuals whose take on reality bears absolutely no relationship to the average person's take on reality. They find offense where everybody else finds credit. You know, you cannot be the Duke and Duchess of Sussex and as overprivileged as they both are, and pretending and convincing yourself that you have been victimized. I mean, victimized by whom? You know, it's all done in very massive, broad strokes. You know, I'm a victim, or, oh, I've been this, I've been that. But, I mean, they never back it up with facts. Nothing that they say is ever backed up with a fact.
Well, hopefully we're going to... Hopefully we are going to get to the bottom of the facts, because now the lawyers have been brought in to get to the bottom of these Meghan bullying claims in the workplace. So hopefully now with external lawyers for both sides, because the Palace have announced that today, hopefully we will get to the bottom of at least one of the issues.
Yes, yes, and you will get to the bottom of it. And believe me, there's an awful lot of... information to come out, rather more dramatic about Meghan's behaviour than has hitherto appeared. And you know, Meghan has tried to silence everybody with threats and lawsuits. Well, let's see how it all pans out.
Indeed.
Because, I mean, the fact of the matter is her behaviour is decidedly unhelpful and very destructive. And it's very sad because, I mean, with a difference in attitude, she could have done so much good.
Yes,
I mean, she was ideally placed to be the most wonderful representative for the royal family and for public service.
Yes, I do agree with you that she has the capacity to do quite a lot of good in the world, whether it's in the royal family or out of it now. We'll wait and see. Lady Colin Campbell joining us live from Castle Goring there in the UK. Very lovely to speak to you this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Well, Melanie Blake's life story is a tale of success and scandal, but not her scandals. After getting a start with the iconic TV show Top of the Pops, Melanie established herself as one of the UK's leading music and entertainment managers. Building one of the most successful boutique agencies, she's represented the who's who of British showbiz.
After two decades at the top, Melanie decided to focus on a smaller client list and dive headfirst into her passion for writing. Her latest book, Ruthless Women, While Fiction, recounts first-hand experiences of the secrets, scandals, betrayals, outrageous behaviour of life on a TV soap. And Melanie Blake joins us now live from London. Melanie, thank you very much for being with us, and congratulations on the book. talk. This all sounds very salacious. We love it. Let's go back to your early years in the industry. How did you first make the move, I guess, from working on set to behind the scenes as an agent?
Firstly, I'm thrilled to be here. Secondly, I can't believe I'm wearing the same dress that you've just shown in the advert just then. How embarrassing.
No one noticed.
So how did I start? So bizarrely, I started as an extra on the actual very soap operas that I would end up going to represent the talent of. So I had the full journey of the bottom of the ladder all the way to the top. So in England, Coronation Street is the most famous soap. We have EastEnders. We have, for example, you would have Neighbours, Home and Away, Prisoner in the Old Days. They're this big here, Dynasty. I worked on all of them behind the scenes, and slowly but surely I made enough connections that I was able to somehow segue into becoming the least powerful person on the set to the most powerful. And when I say that, it meant I had the keys to the contracts of the stars in the show. So I had the power to negotiate for the network, for them, for their contracts, which was a big leap from once being paid to stand in the background and mouth rhubarb, rhubarb, rhubarb.
So managing people in the entertainment industry would come with its, let's call it, challenges. What would your day-to-day look like? You must have been called upon to do some quite astonishing things.
Oh, when I was in my management career, everything from hiding sex tapes to, you know, like blackmail to covering bankruptcies to checking people into, you know, hospital when they'd had nervous breakdowns. Soap stars do not live normal lives. They live as dramatic a life as you see on screen, but in many ways, it's even more dramatic before they film that scene because soap opera stars don't get paid that much. I mean, Jason Donovan, in his heyday in Neighbours, wasn't earning a fortune from the show. He made it from music and live touring and famously had a major addiction and ended up very unwell. And that is very much the case that I've discovered with most stars. There's always a problem lurking behind the camera.
Yeah, it sounds like you had to get very adept at managing your talent stable psychologically as well. You've managed a lot of soap stars over the years, as Kylie's mentioned. We love that this is fiction here. How did that shape your book, Ruthless Women?
So I would say that Ruthless Women is maybe more of something that we might call faction.
Yeah.
So it's based on a soap opera that would be a little bit like The Sullivan meets Downton Abbey.
Oh.
It's a strange combination of a show that's been on air for 39 years. It's syndicated all over the world, and it's very gentle. But as we know, the world has changed. Everyone now is watching reality, and so the network gets sold to an American woman who comes over to change it and turn it into a modern show. And all the women on the soap have been subject to ageism, sexism, and terrible behaviour by the men for years. And they think that when this woman, Madeleine Kane, arrives, she's going to help them, but it turns out that she's the biggest monster of all. So she unleashes a battle of the sexes that they all depend on each other to try and survive the reboot, and it's on a beautiful island. It could be anywhere. It is set in Jersey, but it could be Australia, it could be Canada, it could be anywhere. And if they lose their job on the show, they lose their home. So these women end up fighting to the death to survive.
Right, Jutha, now what about the raunchy stuff? We know you can't name names, but...
Names.
But now, but you know, we're all the way down here in Australia. Who's
Kylie's like, yeah, let's just get away, let's do away with these hidden names.
Well, any stories you can spill?
Well, I mean, this book has been described as everything that 50 Shades of Grey should have been. And that's no offence to 50 Shades, it wasn't my cup of tea. But in this book, if a man got out some handcuffs and a blindfold, the women would trick him into wearing them, laugh at him and go out for the night. No man takes advantage of a woman in this book. They are sexually empowered and they are in control. And I discovered here, I'm in my 40s now, but all the actresses here are on very special combinations of HRT that give them a very strong libido, shall we say. So these ladies are leading ladies in many ways, and they might lose in the boardroom, but they don't lose in the bedroom.
Wow.
And there is one famous scene in this book where an actress is on her way to a soap awards, and she quite likes the driver that comes to pick her up. He's 25, and she's in her 50s, and the next minute they're having relations. And I myself witnessed that very scene with a world famous soap star that you all know, that's on your screens, that's everywhere. And I was literally holding her handbag in shock. But it's in the book, so I don't mind what I saw.
Very interesting. And just before we let you go, Melanie, a bit of a pivot here, but you have a connection to Australian rock legend Michael Hutchence. Can you tell us about that?
I do. I'm actually wearing his ring. Actually see it.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was with Michael on and off for a couple of years. I mean, to be honest, there were a lot of us that were with Michael. Michael was a very, very popular guy. And I knew him in the 90s when I was working at Top of Pops, and he was just the most gorgeous guy. Did you guys meet him?
Not personally, no, I didn't.
You'd never have forgotten him if you knew him. And he was just the loveliest, loveliest, kindest guy ever. And it's such a waste that he went the way that he did. But one day, Kylie and I were in the studio together with him, all at Top of the Pops, and we'd all been out with him. It was the weirdest day ever. And he just came in. He was just like, "You're right, girls. You're right, girls." Like nothing, and we were just like, "Yeah, okay," because he was just so cool.
Yeah, very, very charismatic. Terrific chat. The book looks very entertaining. Thank you so much, Molly. Great to chat to you.
Angie, thanks for having me.
Well, Candace Warner has always been quick off the starting blocks, from paving her way as a superstar Iron Woman to showing her true grit on SAS Australia.
Now, if she wasn't busy enough, the Australian athlete is raising three gorgeous girls with cricketer husband David Warner. And now Candace is heading trackside for a fashionable new project.
The Morning Show has partnered with the Australian Turf Club ahead of the Longines Golden Slipper, and Ambassador Candace Warner joins us now live in the studio. Candace, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You look fantastic.
Thank you. A little bit extra special leaving the house this morning, dropping the kids off to school. Everyone's looking at me like, what's going on?
What were they saying? You're a bit understated this morning?
Just a little bit. Because what you usually in... leisure wear, but Johnny Galella has dressed me today, and I'm all ready for a day at the races.
Beautiful. Oh, happy birthday for last Sunday.
Thank you. It was
what'd you do?
Well, actually didn't do a lot.
That sounds like a good day.
You know, when you've got three kids and it's a weekend, you can't do too much. So I spent it with the family.
Yeah, very nice. Beautiful. And this year you're on board as a Longines Golden Slipper Carnival Ambassador. We already saw you at the Pink Fashion Lunch that was on the weekend, raising money for the McGrath Foundation. Mm. Must be nice to see everyone out on the field for such a great cause.
Yeah, so on Saturday at the Pink Fashion Lunch, it was so great to see everyone back on track wearing a splash of pink. And like you said, it was for the McGrath Foundation, and we all know they do such great work with the breast care nurses throughout our country.
Yeah, they do, don't they? Mm. So it must be, so you're combining a couple of your loves there with the cricket and also the racing. Golden Slipper Day this Saturday. Okay, what do we need to know?
So Golden Slipper is going to be the Longines Golden Slipper Day. There's five Group 1 races. So it's the richest race in the world for two-year-olds. So it's a really, really big day. There is, for the main race, I'm looking at the horse Stay Inside, which is trained by Michael Friedman. But then on the other hand, this really is Gay Waterhouse's event. Mm-hmm. She's won seven slippers before. Her father's won six. And, I mean, she is the queen of the Golden Slipper.
It
would be fantastic to see her win another one. So if you want to have a bit of a flutter, it would be probably wise to put on something trained by Waterhouse.
Mm. At least have a little bit of a savour on the Waterhouse.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So after a year where we couldn't really get to the track that often, what else are we going to see there, Candace?
So also there is an online competition as well as a competition on the day where it's a Longines Elegance Award. So you can, like I said, enter online, and it's for male and female. And don't forget to wear a touch of gold. So whether it be gold shoes, like myself, gold socks, gold headband, or for the gentleman, maybe a gold tie. Add a little bit of gold for the day.
And do you have any other style tips for the big day?
Oh, you know, wear something comfortable. I'm sorry, no.
Hang on, isn't that incongruous? Yes. You can't wear something comfortable and fashionable,
yeah,
can you?
Well, last week I wore some shoes that I hadn't worn before, so very rookie error. Oh, stumbling out as soon as I got in the car, it was, you know, shoes off. But, you know, you do want to look good, but at the same time, you've got to dress for comfort as
well. Isn't that dangerous when comfort and fashion collide, Kyle?
Yeah, well, it doesn't happen often, I can tell you.
No.
Hey, speaking of talking about stylists, we've got these very cute photos of your hubby, David, doing your little girl Isla's hair. I mean, he might get the call up. A bit of a... Everyone needs a side hustle these days.
Yeah, absolutely. So I probably won't get him to do my hair and makeup for this Saturday.
What, are you suggesting he's not quite up to scratch?
Well, I don't love his style. Let's put it that way. But the kids seem to love what he does. But the girls are always like, oh, Dad, oh, oh. But, you know, he tries his best, that's for sure.
He's getting full points for effort. I mean, look at that.
I think he's
doing a great job.
And well, he's good with the hair these days because he's got extra facial hair himself to look after these days.
Yes,
are we a fan of them? Where are we standing?
I actually like it, but it does need to be trimmed a little bit more often. And the girls are always, Dad, shave it off, shave it, it's itchy.
Really?
But
so the girls want it gone?
The girls want it gone. Mm. I actually don't mind it. I actually find it quite attractive. I know everyone has their own thing, but I like it.
Was it in Movember? Did he start doing that for Movember?
No, he just started it because he likes it.
It actually does look good. It gives him a certain je ne sais quoi.
Yeah, I don't mind it. And but he'll be joining me at the races this Saturday, so I'm really excited. We don't often get to go to events together because he's either playing cricket or on the other side of the world. So it will be lovely to attend the Longines Golden Slipper together this weekend.
How's he going?
He's going good. Yeah, so he's
with the injury. Yeah,
yeah, not too bad. He's off to, I think it's Tasmania tomorrow to play a game there on Thursday, and it's coming along. He's been playing a little bit of cricket for New South Wales, and
we need him back.
I know.
Just
so,
quietly.
Yeah, and it's a really big year. We've got a World Cup later on. There's an Ashes towards the end of the year, so we need him at 100%.
I love how you had to think. I think he's off to Tasmania.
Adelaide last week. It's India in a couple of weeks. There's you know. It is
a nuts schedule, isn't it?
It is, but it works, and we work as a team. And there's also, you know, like I said, there's a trip to India, there's a trip to England, the Caribbean, Bangladesh, back to India. I mean, there's a lot to fit in this year.
And he just won't have a job as a hairstylist. That's all right.
Not for me.
That's all right. Thanks, Candice.
Thanks so much. And now this segment was brought to you by the Australian Turf Club. For more info about the Longines Golden Slipper Carnival, you can head to theraces.com.au. And Candice will be there with David.
Well, the one, soulmate, Mr. or Mrs. Right, or as we like to say, the Larry to your Kylie.
Most of us are sold the idea that there's a single perfect love match waiting for us out there, and it's only a matter of time till destiny brings you together to ride off into the sunset and live happily ever after. But our next guest argues that is a misguided myth.
Dr. George Blair West's new book delves into matters of the heart and says when it comes to long-lasting love, singles need to stop waiting and start choosing, taking charge to create your own fairy tale future.
And we welcome psychiatrist and relationship therapist Dr. George Blair West to the show, joining us from Melbourne this morning. Welcome.
From morning,
Brisbane.
Guys. Thanks for
Brisbane.
Having me. Brisbane,
joining us from prison. Hello. Explain why we need to stop waiting for the one.
Yes, this idea of the one has caused an enormous amount of problem, I think, for the particularly the Western world. And it's presided over the highest divorce rate that mankind has seen. It's all about what I call romantic destiny, as you've suggested, this sense that if you just wait, the universe will provide the one, and then you will fall in love. It's a force, you know, like gravity. You don't have to do very much, and you will have this love that will then carry you through life. And of course, well, nothing could be farther from the truth. When we look at what makes successful marriages work, both clinically and in the research, you see that love is built. It's built over time, and it begins, which is what our book is all about, is at the beginning in terms of how we select our partner. It's all about starting a relationship with the biggest head start.
Now, you say we can learn a lot from arranged marriages, actually, and you argue that love can be manufactured. How can we create love from nothing?
Yes, so the arranged marriage research is just fascinating. If we just drill down on one particular aspect, what we find is if you compare the level of love in a love marriage versus an arranged marriage over time, The love marriage starts off with a high level of rated love by the couple. But around 5 years, you see this actually reverses. Arranged marriages score higher on love measures. And by the time you get to 10 years, it's actually around double the level of love on average between arranged marriages and love marriages. Now that, of course, if you think about it, changes everything. It makes us understand that there's a process of building love over time here. And these are people who started with no romantic love at the outset. It's something they've built over time.
So you kind of grow your love. I get it. What about, though, the natural attraction? Does that fit into the picture at all? We're not just going to go out and marry a random person of which there is no spark with.
No, absolutely. But the interesting thing is the manufactured love research, which we just touched on, that shows that you can put strangers together, get them to do certain intimacy exercises, and not only do they fall in love, but in some of these research experiments, these people went on to get married. Now, that, again, is very profound. But, yeah, of course we want there to be a romantic attraction. We're not talking about building it from nothing. But of the people that you can be romantically attracted to, there are some who are better matched than others. And that's really goes to the heart of what our book's about.
Wow. So you also say we should be lowering our standards, right? So instead of going for, a 10 out of 10, we should be heading on down to around the 6 or 7 mark, yeah?
So this is about the level of chemistry. It's not about lowering your standards, but it's about the level of chemical attraction early on, if we call it that roughly, out of 10. Because what you find is the 9s and the 10s, we're often trying to work out often at an unconscious level, some earlier pain. If we've been rejected by a certain person early on in our dating life, we can often find ourselves being intensely attracted to that kind of person, but over time, that relationship pattern shows that we're going to get hurt again and again and again. Whereas when we're down in the 6 or 7 range, so there's enough chemistry there, you find that you've actually got more of a slow burn, which is a much better place to start a relationship. In fact, people who start off with 9 and 10 levels of attraction often have a higher level of separation because they expect that'll carry them through when it won't.
Right, it all burns out and like fizzes. What keeps happy couples together? Is it commitment to make it work even when times are tough? Like this basically, richer and poorer, sickness and in health.
If we reduce it down to one word, you're absolutely right, Carly. It is commitment. And that's what you see. That's how an arranged marriage starts. These people know that they don't have love to carry them through, and so they make a commitment to make it work. And when you go and look at successful love marriages, you find the same thing, that when times are difficult, they commit to working it through with each other. They commit to keeping the relationship growing. They don't take it out on each other. They recognize that their partner is their greatest resource. And that commitment to growing the relationship and to growing your partner and to growing yourself is central to how we redefine love in the book.
Now, apparently men have a particular age when they're prepared to settle down, right?
Yes, this is a really fascinating part, and I think explains a lot of confusion for women, because there are a lot of women who find themselves terribly disappointed when they invest in a relationship that doesn't go anywhere. So you've got to understand that for men in particular, they have a marriage life cycle. They have a kind of their own biological clock, but it's different from that of women. So, for example, men really don't look seriously at getting married when they just graduate university, when they just get that new well-paid job. They want to enjoy that success and that power, if you like, for a period of time, and that's not a good time to expect them to settle down and get married. There's a lot of really interesting research about that. So women who are looking to marry, they need to work out where men are in their life cycle. And that's why we're finding that on average now, men are getting married around the age of 32, women about 30 and a half. And interestingly, that's explaining why our divorce rates are coming down, because they're more mature also when they get married, but they're at this stage in life where they're ready to commit.
Oh, it's fascinating stuff, isn't it? George Blair West, thank you so much for some insights there. Really interesting stuff.
My pleasure, guys. Thanks for
having
me on the show.
Good stuff, George. Thank you, George. His book is called How to Make the Biggest Decision of Your Life, and it's out now.
Well, from food delivery to ride shares, it's fair to say we've experienced a complete revolution in the way we eat and travel in recent years. But our quest for convenience has come at a bit of a price, despite the so-called gig economy being worth more than $6 billion. $1 billion a year in Australia alone. The industry has been plagued with allegations that its largely freelance workforce is underpaid, overworked and unprotected.
In the UK, a landmark court case has just granted 70,000 Uber drivers similar rights to casual employees, including a minimum wage and holiday pay. Now there are calls for the Australian government to step in to fix the problem here with greater regulation of the sector. Here to explain all of this, Seven Network finance editor Gemma Acton. Hi, Gemma. Okay, we're calling this the gig economy. Who falls under this umbrella?
It's a really good question, Kylie. And one of the reasons it is so difficult to measure and track and regulate even is because there is no fixed definition. But loosely speaking, we think of it as those platforms that connect people who want an immediate service on demand with workers who are willing to provide a service on demand. So Uber for taxis, Deliveroo, for instance, for food delivery, and Airtasker for handyman type tasks.
You can understand the appeal for a lot of workers here because the flexibility is very attractive, especially for, you know, thousands that would have, for example, been stood down throughout the worst of the pandemic.
Yes.
So a lot of Australians are in this boat. What are the downsides, though? Because as we've heard there is not a great deal of protection for workers here.
No, there really aren't. And it really depends on the company you sign up to. But generally speaking, no minimum wage, no holiday pay, no sick pay, no super, and often no workers' compensation, which is really worrying if you get into an accident. And tragically, there are many accidents.
Well, they do the bulk of their work at work out on the road,
exactly.
These drivers, don't they?
Yes,
exactly.
So that's a kind of detail buried in the fine print, and a survey found that nearly half of the rideshare guys and the food delivery guys didn't realise that they weren't covered under workers' compensation. So that's a worry.
It really is. Often what you'll see, sadly, is the most vulnerable people in Australian society taking these jobs. There are generally very low barriers to entry, so you don't need any qualifications frequently. If you're driving, you just need a driving licence. So it's an easy job to get. There's an infinite amount of these jobs. You just sign up to a platform and you start straight away. But often we have people who have a limited grasp of English and no grasp whatsoever of their legal rights. So it can take advantage of the more vulnerable.
And I wonder whether a lot of Australians are putting their heads in the sand in terms of the return that these sorts of workers are getting. I'm staggered to hear that as little as $3 a delivery, 70% of riders are struggling to pay bills and food. We need much better regulation of this sector.
We do. Now, these companies traditionally have had a lot of success in making the point that these people aren't workers. And as you say, it's a popular service, and not just amongst Australians, but people all around the world. We love getting cheap taxi rides. I do, I'm sure we all do. We love getting our food delivered. So there hasn't been a big push to do much about it. And many of these companies have really big PR and lobbyist firms to ensure that they keep getting their own way. I would say, though, that we are starting to get some sort of pushback now. People are beginning to sit up and notice and feel guilty about it.
Look, it's very successful, so the companies themselves are making the money. I mean, you can pay up to $9 to get your food delivered. So someone's getting a slice of the pie. They're just not giving it to the people doing the job.
They are, but often we're just not paying enough for services as they require. Like, often we are just not paying very much. If we get food delivered over quite a long radius and we're only paying $3 or $5 for a delivery, that's really not enough to be a minimum wage for a driver. So we've got to find a balance between what we're willing to pay, what workers are getting, and what the companies are making.
So how do we get to that balance? Because people aren't going to volunteer to get there themselves, unfortunately. After we've seen this ruling in the UK about Uber, there are calls for Australia to sort of do the same thing. But how do we get there? Is this going to have to be something that's legislated?
Yeah, look, I think that's really important, this decision in the UK. So a Supreme Court ruling saying that, as you mentioned earlier, these workers have some workers' rights, not full workers' rights, but some workers' rights. And that is a minimum wage, and that is holiday pay. So that's hugely important. I do feel there's more momentum growing. Regulators are sitting up and taking notice. We had the terrible situation in Australia last year where 5 delivery riders were killed in the space of 2 months. Some of these deaths weren't even reported to the regulator. But subsequent to that, the New South Wales government launched an inquiry into it and has come up with draft guidelines and regulations to look at the sector. And I do think we're getting momentum towards giving more rights to these workers.
But you're right, at the end of the day, what does it mean? Well, it means that we as consumers have to pay more to the service to cover things like holiday pay and sick pay. And will consumers be prepared to do that? I'm not sure.
We'll have to wait and see.
Will.
Yeah, so that's where we're going to end up, finding a better balance, because right now it's clearly not working for the workers.
Right. So is there anyone watching right now and they're
interested in maybe doing this? What do they need to remember, Gemma?
Look, it can be great for some people. Now, you can use this as a to supplement your existing work.
Like a uni student might be an Uber
driver. Well, last year during
driver.
The pandemic, when a lot of people had a lot of time on their hands and had other work that wasn't as plentiful as it normally would be, they use this to supplement their income on their terms, understanding the risk. And so it can be a wonderful thing to do as a side job, as long as you're aware of your rights. So if you do plan on signing up, just make sure you have a really good understanding of what you do have and what you don't have, because you don't want to have an accident and then find out at that moment that you have no protection in place.
Yeah.
You've never used one of these services, Jim?
I've used Uber. I haven't used a few deliveries.
This is homework. I'm the only Australian who's never had something delivered in that way. It's extraordinary.
I'm staggered,
and I feel stunningly lazy, because with the new the contactless delivery, they just drop it off and knock on the door, and you feel sublimely lazy.
Gemma has no idea what you're talking about. She's got no idea what you're talking about. Thank you, Gemma. Well, this Sunday is World Down Syndrome Day, and the public is being asked to strap on dancing shoes and help raise awareness. The Australian Ballet School has rocked this routine. Even the Carlton Footy Club has given it a crack. Now stage and screen star Tim Campbell and the crew from Emotion 21 are urging Aussies to post themselves grooving and moving.
It's estimated that between 13 and 15,000 Australians have Down syndrome, and it's considered the most common cause of intellectual disability. In spite of the adversity and exclusion they often face in the workforce, the Down syndrome community are raising their hands and their voices and saying, "Count me in." And Tim Campbell and dance instructor Emily Woodward join us now live from Melbourne. Morning, guys.
Hi, guys. Morning.
Tim, this is so great and such an important and a special cause. How did you get involved and help us understand, I guess, just why this is so important to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I got involved many years ago now. I was many years ago, they asked me to host the Emotion 21 dance concert, which they perform every year. And it was the infectious energy. I mean, the talent is beyond, I can tell you right now. But the energy just both on and off stage won me over straight away. And then a great friend of mine, Jane Kennedy, who was the ambassador at the time, asked if she could pass the baton on. And I was in straight away. So programs like Emotion 21 just give so many great people with Down syndrome the ability to, like Emily, she's got the moves, to dance, and a lot of fitness programs as well. And then, like you say, be able to move on to programs like Impact 21, which teaches a lot of people with Down syndrome how to gain tertiary education and also great skills at life. And that's what World Down Syndrome says, that and so many other things. It's all about inclusion. And that's what this dance program, everything was about.
Great. Emily, let's bring you in here. We hear that you love teaching other people how to dance. We can tell. What do you enjoy most about this job?
Well, I actually love teaching. I actually done it last night. And I just absolutely love it. Seeing the students smile, it makes me have fun as well. So it's perfect.
Yeah.
Emily, I've been watching some of your moves. You are a phenomenal dancer. Are there some people that you think just cannot be taught to dance? Because I fear I'm in that category. But you're an excellent dance teacher. I mean, are there some people where you just go, nah, I can't help?
Do you think we should get Matt and Kylie maybe to learn the dance too at one point? Don't you think?
Yeah, maybe.
Oh yeah, all the socials, get it on there.
Kylie told me she's the best dancer going around just a little while ago.
Yes, so. I did actually say that.
You did say that verbatim.
Don't know how I might have to prove it, and that might be where the whole argument comes unstuck. Tim and Emily, we are going to learn the dance and put it up on our socials. I've roped Matt in. Tim, tell us about the dance. We're seeing it pop up everywhere online. How can a dance capture people's imagination and promote this cause?
Well, dance is such a universal language. Everybody loves dance and knows what dance makes you feel. So, and because Emotion 21 does teach a great dance program, they've created this really easy and fun dance for everybody to learn. And you'll see it all on our social medias. It's on mine. It's on some others. If you look up emotion21.org.au or look in their Instagram pages, you'll see the dance. What we'd love people to do is learn this easy dance you're seeing on the screen now. That's the Talented Australian Ballet School learning it. Do this dance, tag us in it so we can see as well, and share amongst your friends. And we love everybody to get in the spirit of the dance. And all it is, it's about inclusion. I mean, having World Down Syndrome Day this Sunday, that's what the message is all about, is that we can all, as one, involve our great friends with Down syndrome. I mean, as we said before, You know, it is one of the most common forms of intellectual disability, but there's only less than 5% of people in that age who actually have employment, who are the right age to be employed in Australia, and we want that number to go up because there's so much more that people with Down syndrome can offer the world. I think maybe we might be a bit quick to judge sometimes and we think more about what they can't do than what they can do. So, and you'll see they have so much to offer the world, I mean Australia and the world. So as part of that, we want this inclusion message to be out there. So we want everybody to learn the dance, put it on your social media, and we'll, and also we'll have a little competition to see whether Matt and Kylie are as good as Emily. I'm going to say no. Emily shows me up every time we dance, and I don't like dancing with her.
Don't be too harsh to judge. Emily, what is Tim like as a dad? Have you had to rate Tim? What's
he
like?
He's all right. He's pretty good.
I said $50 for a ride is $100. He said, I'm really good. You're only getting $50 here.
No, we've got the truth there, Tim. You can't bend the truth. Hey, Tim, just quickly, it was over 10 years ago we saw you on stage in Wicked. Any chance we might see you back in the theatre anytime soon? Or are you just going to stick to dancing?
No, dancing's definitely not in the CV. Look, maybe not the music theatre stage, but I have my band, which we've been out of action for at least 12 months now. So COVID's slowly but surely dissipating, as we all know, in this country. Well, it's never going to go. But I'm hoping to get the band back up on the stage. I've got concerts that were postponed from last year on there. I work a lot in the events world with the band. So it's slowly but surely where our industry is coming back again. So I'm looking forward to getting everybody on the dance floor. I do 80s daggy dance moves. I'm not as good as Emily, but maybe that can be next year's dance to learn. I can do that. I can do a body roll quite easily.
Is that a body roll, is it?
Yes, Emily's
a body roll. It's called the itchy shoulder, I think.
Really terrific to see you all. I love the initiative. Good stuff. Thank you, Emily.
Thank you,
Tim. It's a great message. Now, this Sunday is World Down Syndrome Day. If you want to get involved, learn the dance. We're going to put all the details up on our website about how you can do it too.
Well, to be a fly on the wall in a recording studio, that's the idea of New York Times digital reporter Joe Coscarelli talking to the world's biggest hit makers. He's giving us a bit of a sneak peek into the star's creative process.
Oh, my God.
Hey.
Hello.
Oh, hi.
Okay, it's happened. We're in business.
If you've ever wondered what goes into making a smash hit, Joe Coscarelli may have found the answer.
In the studio, I'm like obsessively going over every lyric and making sure that's what I want the final lyric to be.
The New York Times reporter created online series Diary of a Song, where he interviews the world's biggest recording artists and their collaborators.
I don't want to be in the pop world. I don't want to be in the alternative world or the hip-hop world or the R&B world. I want it to be like, what kind of music you listen to? Billie Eilish kind of music.
Ed Sheeran, Justin Bieber, Dua Lipa, Lizzo. Joe is uncovering the secret stories behind the songs that you just can't get out of your head.
It's the little details like that that make a song from a good song to a magical moment.
Joe Coscarelli joins us live from New York this morning. Hi, Joe. You really get to peel back the layers of these global hits. How did Diary of a Song come about?
So Diary is a collaboration between three desks at the New York Times, the culture department where I work, along with video and graphics. And we started, trying to figure out how a song of the summer is made. And so we made this video with Justin Bieber and Diplo and Skrillex. We made one with Ed Sheeran, but these were high budget videos and they took a long time and a lot of money. So when we wanted to figure out how to do them more often, we came up with the idea of FaceTime, which made the interviews more intimate. It made the artists easier to wrangle, and it met the viewers where they were, which was on their phones.
Yeah, absolutely. You're a step ahead of the curve as it played out with COVID as well. All the interviews being done via Skype and online, and you've beaten them to the punch. As listeners, we hear the finished song, Joe, really, but often don't realise what has gone into making it such a unique hit. Billie Eilish told you something very interesting about her song, Bury a Friend. We just want to play a bit of this now.
I was in the dentist chair, and they were shaving off my Invisalign attachments, and it was this loud, like, and I thought it was so dope, and I pulled out my phone immediately and pressed record.
I mean, it's so enterprising. One of the other things that Billie Eilish did was use the beeping noise from the pedestrian crossings in Sydney to turn that into the bad guy hit. I mean, this is, I guess, what you're showing through your chats is the funny little things that go into making these monster hits.
Yeah, exactly. We had one recently with Olivia Rodrigo and, you know, her hit driver's license. She uses the sound of her mom's car that her mom recorded on her cell phone.
Oh, wow. That's wow, what a huge hit that is. Billie Eilish, Dua Lipa, Taylor Swift, all praised for their Grammy performances this week. You've spoken to each of them about their songwriting secrets. So can you actually enjoy watching them and listening to them, or are you constantly analysing the music?
I mean, I'm big fans of all of those artists you named, in addition to, you know, other Grammy performers like Lil Baby and DaBaby and Bad Bunny. I think interviewing them and knowing a bit about their process actually makes me enjoy their music more because I know what went into it.
And I suppose what you're doing as well is you're giving their fans a more comprehensive understanding of what goes into making some of these songs that they, you know, a lot of people grow up with or fall in love with. And has that been the reception that you've received from a lot of the fans, that they're appreciating learning more about the creative process?
Yeah, definitely. And one of the things I love is when fan bases are begging their artists to do a diary of a song. You know, BTS fans are always finding me on social media saying, "We need a diary, we need a diary."
Wow, that's really high praise, Joe. So we've had dentist drills, we've had cars, we've had pedestrian crossings. Anything else that really surprised you or stood out?
All of the rap songs that we've done are very important to me. You know, we've done Sheck West, Mo Bamba, Lil Tecca, Ransom, Old Town Road, 5EO Foreign. And these are songs that I think sort of blow up the traditional idea of songwriting, because a lot of them are improvised. Some of them are done in one take. Some of them are done with collaborators that have never been in the same room. And I think that's just really special and representative of how music is made today.
Wow. And I'm just going to pretend like I know who all those people you just said.
Me too. I'm nodding along. Yes, very
yes,
learnedly.
Oh, yes.
Joe, who else is on your interview hit list, if you like? You've had some huge stars already. Is there anyone that you're still lusting after?
I mean, Taylor Swift was a white whale for a long time because the way she documents her own songwriting process was a big inspiration for the series. But now that we've gotten her, which was great for Lover, I think Drake is really at the top of the list. You know, there's not a bigger hitmaker for this generation. And he's just so, you know, secretive about his process. That I would love to, you know, he's definitely up there.
Well, Drake's a Monster Morning Show fan, actually, so we'll just put a word out to him. You're welcome,
we'll make
Joe.
That happen.
We'll make that help.
As
we'll
say goodbye,
okay,
Joe.
Appreciate it.
As we say goodbye, do you have a favourite song that you've all has become a favourite song after you've learnt after you've dissected it?
I will say, you know, I have a different favorite song every day. Right now, I've been really into the group SWV, the R&B group from the 90s. They have a song called Weak, and there's an a cappella version of it that I've just been listening to all the time because the harmonies really come out without the backing track.
Oh, wow.
We have our homework.
Yes.
Yeah.
we'll get to them before you do, Joe. It's a race.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Joe. And it's called Diary of a Song, if you want to go
looking for it. Very clever
idea, isn't it? It's a great idea.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Sydney schoolboy Jack Byrne was just 10 years old when he launched A Fiver for a Farmer. Remember that? It was a charity initiative that raised close to $2 million for locals on the land and gained international attention along the way.
It was such a great concept. If that wasn't impressive enough, Jack is now gearing up to launch his brand new initiative. And this time, he's going old school. All you need is a pen, some paper, and a postage stamp. Jack Byrne joins us now. Jack, good morning.
Hi, guys.
G'day, chat.
You are just full of enthusiasm and wonderful ideas, aren't you? I mean, you've had another one here. I want to ask you about that in a minute. But first, tell us about how this great initiative, Fiver for a Farmer, how that's helped so many people.
Yeah, well, just all that money that's been raised, I just really wanted to do something cool with it. And the two charities that I'm with have really kept me in the loop, and the stuff they do with it is just so amazing. Getting kids Christmas toys, making musicians in rural towns. It is just so amazing what they do with the money, like Visa cards. But now we're actually a registered charity, so that means I can do more with the money, which is really exciting. And yeah, there's lots more to come.
So. You sound like a CEO. You look like a CEO there as well in your tie, Jack. Yeah. It's actually your school uniform, but you look like you're ready to take over the world.
I was going to say that you're in Year 7 now. It's important people in Year 7 are kept in the loop, as you say. Very, very important. $2 million you raised. That's a lot of money. In anyone's language, Jack.
Yeah.
It's doing so much good work.
It's so crazy.
You said that you wanted to, you found the heart of the towns, of these rural towns.
Yeah.
During your travels, that's what you found. What is the heart?
Well, everywhere I go, like, they just talk about the post office. Mm. And it's just a social check-in point. You get your mail, and I'm always excited. My sister's excited when you get a letter from Nan and Pa of, like, Christmas birthday cards and all of that. It's just so exciting. And every time I go there, it's a cafe or it's just a check-in point. But it's so important to those towns. And, you know, Amanda, the local post office lady, she knows everything about the town. So if you have any questions, you always go to her. And it's just so much fun.
And Jack, Australia's on the hunt for some good politicians at the moment. I think we can slot you into federal cabinet. What do you think? Have you got any political ambitions?
It's a very hard job from what I've heard.
Yeah. I think you'd do a better job than some of them who are currently employed, Jack. But let me ask you about your new initiative. This is Mail Mates. Yeah. Tell us about it.
So I was just with Mum and we found a box of letters in the shed and it was just all this bubble writing. It was so colourful and all the drawings and all the messages was so cool. And I just thought, like, I don't know how to address a letter and I've never written one to my friend. I've always just texted them or called them. But I just thought that's such a cool idea and I've heard about pen pals, so I kind of wanted to keep my idea of rural communities and tie it all in and start letter writing again because it's so cool.
Bring back the art of letter writing, make letter writing cool again.
Yeah.
Because things like Snapchat, they disappear, right?
Yeah.
You don't have a permanent record and here you are, you found your mum's box of letters. So how do people support Mailmates? Like if there's somebody at home watching and they want to get involved, how's it going to work?
Just raising awareness and registering your class at school, or if you're a mum, just registering your son's class. We're trying to do classes because it's a lot of paperwork and a lot of safety, so we're trying to keep that at the top. So just registering in a class, and hopefully soon by the end of the month we'll have something sorted because there's a lot of people registering and it's really exciting. So
get the schools on board and look up Mailmates and take it from there.
As the most accomplished Year 7 CEO in Australia, do you promise to keep us in the loop?
Yeah, definitely.
About how this goes, Jack.
Definitely.
Who are you going to write your first letter to?
I'm not sure, but I'm so excited to write a letter. I'm just so keen and It just looks awesome. Like, I could write about whatever I want, and just to read what someone's written and what someone wants to talk about is really cool.
And you've made a fan in the Prime Minister.
Yeah, he's so nice. He's amazing. He's always checking in. And
he's getting a lot of mail at the moment, but you could write him a letter.
Yeah, he's awesome.
Hey, you were talking about bubble writing, Jack.
Yeah.
Is this what your mum's bubble writing looked like?
Oh, bubble writing.
Oh, yeah. Here, look at this. Is this what bubble writing was when you looked?
Yeah, like that.
Hang on, this. Was it like that?
Yeah, it was exactly like that.
That is very good, Kylie.
So I think your mum and me might be roughly of the same era because I'd forgotten I could do bubble writing.
You've lost none of your touch.
Thank you. Do you know what? My maiden name used to be Mills, so I can't. Hang on, here we go. Mills. And then the S's were good.
Oh, very good.
I forgot
good.
About the S.
So you've got it.
Kylie. Where are we at? Kylie Mills.
That's awesome.
Fantastic. You've got, when you learn the art of letter writing, you've got to add bubble writing.
Bubble writing.
To your trips.
I love it. Haven't thought about bubble writing in years. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, Jack. Keep up the great work.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, a lot of us have worn different hats throughout our lives and careers, but few have had more roles than Nathan Harvey. Mm. The former It Boy from the 90s was a male model, a TV host, a professional water skier, even part of crew for an airline.
But at age
look at four, that.
But at age 44, he decided to try something new and picked up a guitar for the very first time. Now he is a fully fledged musician with a few singles under his belt. Nathan Harvey joins us live. Hi, Nathan.
Hi, Kylie. How are you? Hi,
great. Nathan. Nice to see you again. We're going to get to the new music soon. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about this show that you've been doing and performing, Confessions of a C-Grade Celebrity.
Yes, that's right. And I noticed Larry isn't in today. I'm just wondering whether he thinks I have some dirt to dish on him or something.
I thought you were suggesting Larry was a C-grade.
He's writing his own chapter on in this.
Yeah. Well, that was a lot of it was through the naughty 90s, and thankfully we didn't have smartphones or anything like that back then, and otherwise I think we may have been in trouble.
Well, do tell, Nathan, what stories?
Mm. Oh, there's all sorts of stories, far out. I mean, I've been chased by a biker through the middle of the city when I was driving my old Valiant, and it was like a scene out of a movie, and I had to ring the security at Foxtel and say, I'm coming in hot, and they were all there, and the biker turned around and went away. And
what had you done? What have you done to annoy the biker?
Oh, well, I'd accidentally, and this was accidentally, because when you're well known, you get targeted a bit. And, yeah. He was having a fight with his ex-missus, and his ex-missus targeted me one night when I was out, and I had a bit of a tryst, and I didn't even know. And then he said he wanted to kill me, and then a couple of weeks later, he came at me with a knife. He came at me with a knife at DCMs at the time, and I thought the bouncers were protecting me, but I just happened to be talking to Johnny Ibrahim at the time, and they thought he was going for John.
Okay, that's a great story. And what other confessions do we have from the
That's millions. All we've got time for.
I mean, I broke my neck water skiing, I've done all sorts of things, and I've had probably three or four very near-death experiences, and all sorts of crazy stuff. And
you've lived quite the life.
Yeah, really
Still
have.
Life,
and a good life and a very varied life, that's for sure. So I'm always up for new things, and it's funny, when COVID hit and everything, people said, geez, you got out of the city quickly, and I'd always been planning to. And for me, change is just normal. And I guess you'd understand as well, being in the industry.
Can we address this just quickly, if you don't mind me jumping in? I'm sorry to be rude.
That's all right.
But I mean, what a heartthrob. How old were we back here?
I can't even remember. Like 19, 20? No, in my mid-20s when I was in Australia.
Do you have a wall of these at home, a bit of a shrine to your modelling career?
Oh, of course. You walk in the door and my whole house is covered in
it. Yeah, no, I had a sneaking suspicion.
No, not like that. They're hidden away in boxes. And I've got lots of boxes, and I've got a lot of scanning to do for the show. So,
And this is your TV presenting. This is the sort of MTV era.
That was Level 23. So that was a show, and the quality's really bad because that was on the days when we were still using U-matic tapes, if you can believe that. And, and then went to SP and then digital, and so I've lost a lot of generations of quality there. But it was fantastic times, and that was done by Beyond. So if you remember Beyond 2000.
Yes.
They actually did it, and they pitched it against the news at the time, and it was a hip young sort of youth show. And I was up for a big sponsorship with Pepsi, around about 100 grand at the time, and I had to actually forego that and to do the show because it was sponsored by Coke. And I lost 100,000 because it only lasted 13 weeks. Gone.
You've got a whole litany of fascinating stories, Nathan.
Well, that's it,
Your life, I mean, you're very agile when it comes to your career, aren't you? I mean, you worked at SeaWorld. Mm-hmm. You performed on Fat Pizza as Dougie the Pizza Boy.
Yeah.
Now you've pivoted, and this is fantastic. I want to ask you about your music. You go by Mr. Harvey.
Yep.
What made you want to pick up a guitar and start to record? I mean, you weren't all that experienced.
Yeah. Well, I'd always been into music, and I hosted Channel V for 5 years, and so and I used to play drums in a band called the Velvet Underpants, which was just a fun band, and and what really did it was probably breaking my neck. I was in Canada water skiing, and I was about a millimeter away from being a quadriplegic, and I came back with my tail between my legs, and I moved in with a guy called Dave. G'day, Dave, if he's watching. And he learned at the conservatorium, so he had a guitar and I had an old guitar floating around. And
did you teach yourself?
Yeah, and I picked it up and I was hooked ever since, and I've been completely obsessed ever since.
Amazing. Well, obsessed insofar as you've released this new single. It's called Superheroes and Racing Cars. What's it about? Where can people hear it, Nathan?
It's about being inspired. I mean, I've been signed now at almost 50 years of age. So
congratulations.
By a label called Foghorn, and it's a wing of Damien Gerard's, and that's where In Excess recorded and Divinyls. And Marshall, the guy that actually signed me, I'm like, oh, my God, because he sort of worked on Hoodoo Gurus albums and stuff that are just some of my favourite of all time. And so,
so
really what this song's about is just dreaming to believe, and you can always do whatever you want to do, no matter how old you are. And I mean, Pete Murray's a good example, and I don't know whether you've seen the documentary Searching for Sugar Man about Rodriguez. Amazing documentary, but I mean, so really and this is just about being a superhero in your everyday life, where, like just doing a random act of kindness and just believing in yourself and backing yourself, really.
So, it's a really good message.
Your music's fantastic. So is your attitude, Nathan. Congratulations as well.
Cheers.
Now that you're shooting back to fame, avoid those bikies, will you?
I will. Well, put it this way. I'm a lot more circumspect with who I decide to date these days, that's for sure.
I thought you may have just been after your Valiant. That's what I thought.
Yeah. The Valiant was the best. I'm really upset I sold that thing. It would be worth about 60 grand now.
Nathan Harvey, a.k.a. Mr. Harvey's new single, Superheroes and Racing Cars, is out right now.
We all do it, some a little better than others, some longer than others. Today on The Y-Files, we're looking at the science of sleeping.
Did you know that getting up for a couple of hours in the middle of the night used to be considered normal? What? Also, we tend to sleep less around a full moon, and during certain sleep cycles, our muscles are paralysed.
Wow.
All fascinating stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a really interesting area of research. With all the answers about what's going on during our sweet, sweet slumber, we welcome back biomedical scientist Dr. Darren Saunders. Doctor, morning to you.
Morning.
Hi, Darren.
Break this down for us. It's obvious why humans need to eat and to reproduce, of course. Why exactly do we need to sleep? What happens when we sleep?
It's a great question. It's, in fact, one of biology's great mysteries, sleep. We know that all animals with any kind of nervous system need some kind of sleep, as we know it. But we really don't know exactly why. We know that it's important for memory formation, and we know that it's important for learning, coordination and things like that. And we know that people who don't get enough sleep are at risk of getting some diseases later in life, chronic diseases. So it is still a little bit of a mystery.
What happens to our brains and our bodies when we are, let's call it, offline?
Yeah. So basically we go unconscious, we get disconnected from the world, and we get, like you said, in some phases of sleep, we get completely paralysed, so we're not moving. We've got a lot of clues about what's going on in the cells in our brain when we sleep, so we know that the sort of connections that we make during the day, which help form our memories and help us regulate our emotions and things like that, seem to get strengthened, and the ones that we don't need kind of get pruned away. We call that plasticity.
Mm-hmm.
We also know that a lot of metabolic waste gets cleared out of our nerve cells in our brain during sleep, and a bunch of other things, like some hormone levels go up and down. Our immune system seems to get a bit of a boost from being asleep. So it's all about repair and regeneration is what it seems
it's
to
like
be about.
Putting the iPhone on charge.
Yes, it's necessary. Like, we can't get by
without. That's a good analogy.
What about gender differences? Like, for example, do men need more sleep or less sleep than women, or is there no difference?
It's a really tough one, because we talk about average sleep patterns, and we know there are chronotypes. So there's some people need more sleep than others. Some people go to bed later than others and wake up earlier than others. There are some studies out there that say that women probably need just a little bit more sleep, maybe 20, 25 minutes more sleep a day on average than men.
But and yet we don't get it, do
that's
we?
That's right. And the reasons for that are very controversial.
A twist. You need more but get less.
Yes.
Where's the equity in that?
What about your research about men being able to sleep through anything?
I'd have to agree with that. I pretty much sleep through anything.
Crying babies, people getting up in the middle of the night.
Selective hearing.
What about how long it takes to get to sleep? Because I find this really interesting. If it takes you less than 5 minutes to fall asleep, so if you climb into bed and bang, you're gone, you could have some problems there.
That seems to be a bit of a hint that we might be sleep deprived. So if you really just, you know, crawl in and your head hits the pillow and you're out, that might be a bit of a signal that you're probably not getting quite as much sleep as you need.
Right.
But again, back to that notion that it's a bit flexible. It's hard to just lump everybody into one basket with sleep, because we know that everybody's kind of have individual patterns of sleep.
If 5 minutes is too quickly to fall asleep, how long should it be taking us to fall asleep?
It looks like 10 to 15 minutes is about the average for most people.
Yeah. 5 minutes is quite the party trick, isn't it? If you can fall asleep within 5 minutes.
My kids do that, no trouble at all. They just hit the pillow.
I know someone that does that.
Yeah. What about there's these tiredness peaks, we might call them, if we might call them that, twice a day, around 2 a.m. and 2 p.m. Anything more than that, you're doing something wrong, I guess.
Yeah, we're a slave to our circadian rhythm, you know, this sort of rhythm of hormones and temperature that our body goes through. And we have this big dip in temperature at nighttime, and that helps to release the chemical melatonin, which makes us feel sleepy. And we have a little bit of a temperature dip just after lunch, but it can also be related to what you eat. If you have a huge, big meal full of lots of starch, it can be related to whether you're just sitting at your desk all the time, if you're getting up and moving around. That sort of 2 p.m., 2 a.m. slump is what most people tend to fit into.
That's why some cultures have like the siesta.
That's right.
Like,
amazing.
Yeah, that they've worked it out in Spain, haven't they? Yeah. They have a siesta and a four-day week.
Yeah, it should be encouraged.
Yeah, I'm all for it.
Okay,
yeah.
Let's talk caffeine. What do we need to know about caffeine and a good night's sleep?
So caffeine is an amazingly powerful drug, and it does two things for sleep. It stimulates part of our nervous system to keep us awake. It also blocks the effect of a thing called adenosine, which is the chemical in our brains that tells us to go to sleep. So caffeine works in two different ways. And so it's different for everybody, but you tend to clear caffeine. It takes quite a few hours for your body to clear caffeine. And so the idea is if you're having trouble getting to sleep, you should really limit your caffeine intake after sort of mid-afternoon, really.
Okay.
The other interesting thing was in order to fall asleep, you actually need to cool down. So would that suggest, like, for example, having a hot shower or having a hot bath before you're going to bed is actually a bad idea?
It's a counterintuitive one, right? You would think that's a bad idea, but when you have a warm shower or a warm bath, it actually opens up all the blood vessels on your skin and lets your body cool faster. So there's actually pretty good research now that a warm bath an hour or two before bed actually helps you get to sleep. It helps that temperature drop.
I'm always so hot when I hop into bed.
Yeah, I like a cool shower before bed. Yeah. Let's not go there again.
How quickly you're breathing again, Darren. I can't freak me out a bit. I was having a joke, and then
And I just decided to stay stunningly silent. Just say nothing at all, and in that case,
really awkward,
nothing bad can happen.
Anyway, Darren, we're never seeing you again on this secret ever again. I can't. We'll have you back. That was the Y-Files with Dr. Darren.
Good on you, Darren. Thank you very much. Well, studies show that 80% of us prefer to buy Australian-made food and beverages, and over half of Aussies link the Australian-made logo with high-quality products.
Yeah, but you might be surprised by which iconic brands are actually owned by overseas corporations.
They are the nostalgic jingles that everyone can sing along to. But could you tell which of these famous local brands are actually Australian owned and made?
Because we love our Vegemites, we all adore our Vegemites, it was around in every cheese.
Vegemite meets the tick of approval, manufactured and owned by the Bega Cheese Group. 4 and 20 Pies, a dinky die, and R.M. Williams is as true blue as they come. But what about this snack?
You know the deal? Three wishes and all that?
Three, huh? All right. I want a packet of Tim Tams that never runs out.
Well, while Tim Tams are still made right here in Australia, Arnott's is actually owned by American investment company KKR & Co. Milo is also foreign-owned, as are Paddle Pops, Uncle Toby's Oats, and, surprisingly, this kid's favourite.
My dad picks the fruit and goes to Connie's to make the cordial that I like best.
While we all want to buy Australian-owned brands, supermarket aisles can be a minefield of conflicting claims and logos. But now, a new government-backed branding system is changing the way we shop.
We've been singing along.
Some catchy jingles there.
We know all the words. CEO of Buy Aussie Now, Chris White, joins us live from Melbourne. Hi, Chris.
Hi, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
Welcome to the show. Why is there such a push from consumers for Australian-owned and made products right now?
Oh, look, my job is the best job in the world because everyone wants this. I think there's such a push because consumers recognise now that there's an opportunity to get behind Aussie Made and really make a difference. I think at the start of the pandemic, everyone went online, and with that came the ability to change the way you buy. And I think consumers not only are looking for great bargains, but they're also looking to make a difference to the world they live in, the community they live in, and of course the economy that they're in.
Sure.
Yeah, and just to support, you know, small Aussie businesses as well. But Chris, even on an international level, it seems like a lot of countries are choosing to preference Australian products.
Look, it's incredible. I mean, the demand for Aussie made, not only in Australia, but across the world is huge. Countries like China, where 1 in 4 purchases of any retail product is done online, the UK, the US, Australian is seen to be better quality and, guys, better value too. And that's a really important message here. Australian made is actually great value, especially when you buy it directly from the manufacturer.
Okay, and safe. I mean, we are the envy of the world over is how we've handled COVID. Are we seen as being a safe bet?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Australian made, typically when you're buying Australian made, you know that it's coming from a manufacturer who's using the best quality materials, especially if they're Australian materials, and it's being manufactured in a great way. Of course, the staff are being treated better, and of course you're helping the community, as I say.
So your company Buy Aussie Now is hoping to change the way we shop. How?
Yeah, absolutely. So look, I think the number one thing about Buy Aussie Now, everything that's online, we've got more than 20,000 products now on the Buy Aussie Now marketplace. Everything is Australian made and it's Australian owned. But the number one thing that I think to point out as a difference is you're buying direct from the maker or the manufacturer. And that's really the difference. I think Australian made sometimes in the past has got a bit of a bad rap for not being the best value or the best price because imported is seen as cheaper. Look, a lot of that has to do with the markup that retailers have to charge to make a profit. But if you can go direct to that maker, especially a lot of the small and medium-sized businesses, you're actually picking up a bargain.
And that's, I think, been a large part of the beauty of what you've started there, Chris, is, you know, providing this greater access direct to the manufacturers. I mean, you started only, I think, what was it, a year ago? You must be so blown away by how successful this has been in such a short amount of time. But this new tick of approval system that you've introduced, we love this. I think it's a fantastic idea. The government's behind it as well. Explain it to us and how it'll work.
Yeah, great. So the tick of approval is really simple. If you're a business on Buy Aussie Now, so right now there's more than 6,500 businesses, 6,500 businesses making incredible products here in Australia. Just by signing up, once you've been approved, you'll get the tick of approval. Now, that's a mark for you to take because on Buy Aussie Now, it's very obvious everything is Australian made and owned and you can trust what's there. But out in the market, that's for them to put on their products, put on their advertising, so people can recognise that it's Australian made and it's Australian owned.
And is that hard to police though? Because we want to be able to trust this. So how can you, you know, how can we trust the tick, I guess?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we've got a team of people who go through the checks. In terms of some of the checks we do, we're looking at who owns the company, not just who makes the product. And that's an important distinction here is the Australian-owned component. It's easy to find that information out. It's just not readily available for consumers, which is why we've gone and put the tick together.
Okay.
So many Aussie companies are going to want the tick. How do they go about getting it? Can anyone sign up? Explain the process.
Yeah, absolutely. So, pardon the plug, but jump online to buyaussienow.com.au and click sell with us. There you can register. It's a really short form. Our team will be back in touch with you as quickly as we can. I would recommend to do it sooner rather than later. Since we did the media launch with the Treasurer Josh Frydenberg only a week ago, we've been inundated. So the first in, best dressed, jump online or go to our Instagram page at buyaussienow and you can follow us there too.
Okay, we've seen a bit of an influx of fake branding, companies adding, you know, tags to cheap foreign products trying to sell them. How do we make sure that what we're buying is legit? So look at this.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Look, unfortunately, Aussie made is seen to be better, so everyone's going to try and claim it. There's no easy way. What I would say is go and do your research. So go direct to that, to the manufacturer. Have a look at their website. Even pick up the phone and give them a call. That's probably the best thing I could suggest. Or go to buyaussienow.com.au, of course.
And you'll do the hard work for us, okay?
We sure will.
Okay, we get it. Thank you. Thank you so much. Congratulations.
Good on you, Chris.
On a great initiative.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's the most common mental health condition in Australia. On average, one in four people will experience anxiety at some stage in their life. But the issue is more than just fleeting fears or the occasional stress. Anxiety can leave sufferers feeling overwhelmed, exhausted, and out of options.
Dr. Jodie Loewinger's debut book, The Mind Strength Method, aims to arm readers with practical advice for conquering worry and building resilience, and argues it's possible to turn anxiety into a superpower. That sounds good.
For more, we welcome clinical psychologist and founder of the Anxiety Clinic, Dr. Jodie Loewinger. Hi, Jodie.
Hi.
Recent studies have declared millennials, especially women, are the most anxious generation in history. What's going on?
In society at the moment, there's overwhelming uncertainty, and it really takes us out of how we're meant to be as human beings. We are designed, our brain is designed to live in a very predictable world where we either have predators or things that are going to protect us. Now there's an overwhelming uncertainty. So whether it's women or kids or teens or men, we're all dealing with this, young and old. The other element is social media and this need or perception that we need to be perfect in order to be okay. So working with parents and kids and teens and all ages, it really is this protective instinct at play, trying to make sure that we're okay in this uncertain, unpredictable world.
Meghan Markle, of course, spoke candidly about her mental health issues with that big interview with Oprah.
Yes.
How important is it that we have these discussions openly and honestly and regularly?
Open conversation is incredibly important. We want to destigmatize and help people to recognize that it's not weak to feel, it's human to feel, particularly anxiety, which is this inherent protective instinct at play. The brilliant thing is, if we can normalize and say this is part of our common human experience, whether you experience anxiety at a mild, moderate, or severe level, connecting with each other and allowing each other to recognize that we are being human here enables us to move from this distress around the emotions that we're experiencing and move into leveraging a practical toolkit, what I call the Mind Strength Toolkit, to feel empowered to respond with helpful actions.
Okay, how does anxiety look in men? Does it look different in men?
There are many faces to anxiety, and oftentimes this can play out differently amongst men, amongst women. The bottom line is awareness around the many faces and what this looks like. Step one in the Mind Strength methodology is actually building awareness. What we have is this fight or flight reaction that tips us into various forms of unhelpful behaviors if we're being fear driven. So the fight might be agitation, frustration, it might be lashing out, or the flight might be avoidance, withdrawal, procrastination. And the other area is need for certainty and control, because in essence, this is an uncertainty problem. We want to feel certain, and that's what worry does, and it throws us into this whirlwind. So awareness around these many faces, whether it's men, women, children, or teens, is an incredible first step, and then we move into practical strategies that make a big difference.
Okay, so a recent headline suggested that as we come out of these COVID restrictions and start to move together back in crowds, that may trigger anxiety for some people. Are you thinking that's going to happen, and how do people get around that?
That can certainly happen because, again, we're kind of getting used to this other weird world that we've all been living in. And so that tips us into uncertainty again. And so what we want to do is build awareness around, am I avoiding here? Am I struggling with the push away from something bad happening? Or am I realigning with something that gives us meaning? And so we approach rather than avoid with a practical toolkit that is really within your control and very helpable. I say anxiety is a helpable experience.
We've just got, we're right out of time. We have a graphic page here. It's called the STOP strategy. And this is some of the tools that you recommend. Stop, take long, slow breaths, observe your surroundings, proceed. Just as a quick little takeaway message, yeah?
Yeah, that's a great takeaway. Moving from worry into problem solving and action planning around what's in your control.
All right, it certainly affects a lot of people. We'll put all the details up on our website. Thanks, Jodie, for coming
in. Thank you.
For more, you can pick up a copy of Jodie's book, The Mind Strength Method. It is out now.
Well, Scotty James may have been pipped at the post taking out silver at last weekend's World Championships, but the snowboarding legend will always be our golden boy, aiming for a fourth consecutive world title in Aspen. The 26-year-old was runner-up to Japan's Yuto Totsuka, the Aussie vowing he will be back bigger and stronger.
James has the final World Cup event to contest with this coming weekend before he heads into off-season preparations. With the 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics just under a year away, Scotty is keeping his eye firmly on the prize. Scotty James joins us live from Aspen. Gee, that sounds nice. Did you? You got out last year, right? Got out of Australia. You had to head to the snow.
Aspen's almost home for you now.
Yeah, it pretty much is. Thank you guys for having me. But I'm over here. I'm in the winter, a little bit different scenario to back home in Australia where it's a little bit warmer. I must say I'm missing that a touch at this point. It's been a long winter. But no, it's been fantastic. And yeah, as you said, over the weekend, it would have been nice to come out on top. I did the best that I could to fly the Australian flag. And as you said, Kylie, I'll be back fighting much harder over the weekend as well next year.
You know, for Olympic gold. How hungry does that make you? Sometimes, you know, a little a little, no, I wouldn't call it a setback because silver is amazing, but sometimes that can make you hungrier, Scotty. What does it do for you?
Yeah, I would say that defines it very well. I'm extremely hungry, and for me, you know, it's been an amazing 6-year journey for me, you know, being very competitive on this world stage. And at this point in my career, obviously in the lead up to the Olympics, it is very important to be motivated and have yourself in that headspace. So over the weekend, that was a very good testament to how I was feeling and how I am feeling right now. And fired up is exactly where I'm at.
Isn't that great? You get it. You can read between the lines, can't you? Because he's deeply seething. Scotty, you had to share around some of the gold. 3 world titles. I mean, it's not like you've been starved. What do you mean you're hungry?
I've had a few world titles now, which is very, very nice. But I must say, I'm not resting till I get a few more and a few other things I'm aspiring to achieve in this snowboarding world. So I'm excited.
It's been very different, of course, this last year for everybody. And being a professional athlete, of course, you're no different. No one could travel anywhere. I mean, how did it impact you and your training and your competition, Scotty?
Yeah, it was impacted us quite a bit. I mean, I finished my season typically around this time. Last year, I flew back to Australia and I was coming to visit my family and just didn't go back. So I went into quarantine. And honestly, I mean, it's been probably the hardest thing for me this year because typically we finish a season and then we go straight into our pre-season training. And that's when I would have learned a lot of my new tricks and whatnot to implement into my competitions runs for this year. So I didn't really get that time. So I got back on snow in October. We had a lot of events canceled in December and then we started up in January. So it's been very different for sure, but you know, it's been important to be able to adapt. And I think for me personally, you know, looking at the big picture where it was very tragic for a lot of people around the world. And, you know, I think it's important that we really focus on that. I mean, people were very, very sick and, you know, it was a global crisis. So I was, you know, very happy to be home with my family and being safe. So that was the most important thing.
How's it been in the competitive sport world, Scotty, trying to manage COVID? I mean, you're over there in Aspen at the moment. What sort of testing procedures have they got in place? How has this affected things for you in terms of actually getting out there on the slopes?
I've done every single COVID test under the sun now. many, many swabs up the nose, down the throat, you name it. But we've so we do, during the competition week, we do anywhere between 2 to 3 tests. So we arrive, we get tested, then we can get our credentials to go into the venue. And then we get tested again during the week on the practice days. And then, so every single test has to be negative within, you know, 24 hours of us entering the venue or going into the competition. So it's been very, you know, they've been very, very safe for us. And they've created a great environment to make sure that we're all doing the right thing and following the protocol. And I have no issues doing that, obviously, as long as it gets me in the half pipe to compete. So grateful that we even got to get the season going.
And let's face it, there are worse places to spend COVID than in the Aspen Library with, I'm sure, the garden fireplace there. Hey, Scotty, enough shop talk. We love your social media. We can't help but notice you've upped your dancing ability because you're quite good on your feet.
You've got the moves.
Putting it out there, could we rope you in for a spot on Dancing with the Stars? Dancing with the Stars is back on the 7 Network. What do you say?
I would, you know, if someone approaches me with an offer to go and Dance with the Stars, I would consider. My girlfriend might be a little bit upset that she won't be my partner, but at least she could probably sit on the sidelines and encourage me. But, my dance moves, I must say, don't quite reflect what I do on snow. Not so great, which is the dancing, and then the snowboarding kind of makes up for it.
Thank goodness you can snowboard, basically.
Is your girlfriend Aussie or what?
No, my girlfriend's actually Canadian. She lives in Europe.
Okay.
Yeah, all right.
We'll let you have that one.
So, Scotty, just by, like, judging by the background there, you'd have us believe you've spent your time in Aspen just reading as many books as possible, feverishly reading up. But you've actually been getting out and hitting the bars, have you? Or what have you actually been doing in Aspen?
He's an athlete.
please.
Yeah, I'm just about to, you know, once we get off this interview, I'll probably open up a book and, yeah, you know, just spend some time sitting on the couch, okay. Couch being the very smart individual that I am.
That's right. Very learned, Scotty.
We've been training a lot and definitely, you know, had a little celebration after the silver on the weekend. So
and well deserved.
No complaints.
Too.
Congratulations.
We'll let you get back to your TikToks. Thanks, Scotty. Always good to catch
thank you, guys.
All the action from the 2022 Winter Olympics, as well as this year's Summer Games, right here on 7. Thanks for joining us on another edition of the Morning Show podcast. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button.
Thank you for spending this time with me, Kylie. I've really enjoyed our extra time together.
me too.
We can't even say that without laughing. For more on these stories, head to themorningshow.com.au and you can find full episodes over there on 7+.
And you can catch us again weekdays right after sunrise.
Bye Kylie.
Bye, Kylie.
Bye,
everyone.